Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And the headline across the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, Massive Update of IT for First Citizens. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And at the far right of this article, there is a picture of a man sitting at a desk in a suit and tie. The caption reads, Frank Holding Jr. heads up First Citizens. Note to local businesses looking for new contracts, First Citizens Bank of Raleigh is about to embark on a multi-million dollar modernization project. The Raleigh-based bank holding company will launch a major technology upgrade in a move that will take 3 years to complete. The $21 billion total asset lender has also decided to exit some traditional business lines, such as the to-do list that First Citizens outlined in rough detail in its recent 2012 annual report filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. On the tech front, bank officials have offered few details, other than saying the update will take until 2016 to finish and that it will represent a significant investment. Asked about the matter, First Citizens spokesman Frank Smith says the bank would let the filing speak for itself. In July, First Citizens recruited Didi Romaneda from Progress Energy to be the bank's chief information officer, citing as her strong point an ability to manage complex technology projects. Romaneda presumably will play a leading role over the next 3 years as First Citizens updates the core tech platform at its Raleigh headquarters and across its 418-branch footprint stretching all the way to California. The situation with a lot of banks is that they have been running the same core IT platform for as long as 20 years or more, patching new things on as they went along, says bank analyst Don Coker. It gets to be like a Rube Goldberg contraption after a while, and when the time comes for a change, it can get expensive. A bank's core platform handles the accounting on everything from ATM transactions to security sales to trust accounts. In moving now to deal with its legacy system, First Citizens is also jumping onto a gathering wave. North American bank IT spending, flat in the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown, has been picking up in recent months and is on track to hit nearly $57 billion in 2013, up 4% from the prior year, says Jacob Jager of Boston-based Celent. First Citizens has not announced any vendor relationships in the IT makeover. As for the exited business lines, the annual report says the move to pull the plug on the offerings came after a 2012 review showed them no longer profitable. One of those lines is First Citizens Working Capital Division, which purchased and collected short-term receivables from companies. The businesses use the service as a source of ready cash. Also cut from the Bank Stock Transfer Division, which provided various shareholder services to customers. In a third legacy line also eliminated, First Citizens will no longer be providing data processing, trust, and stock transfer services to community banks and other financial service providers for a fee. At its height, 60 smaller banks got such back-office support from the Raleigh Bank. That client list was reduced, First Citizens now says, by rapid consolidation in the banking industry. And as we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we come to our cover story. And this is actually two stories inside of a black box that takes up most of the page. In bold black and gray lettering at the very top inside that box, there's the headline, Dual Strategy, How Chimerix is Getting Its Groove Back. And then right under that, there's a landscape picture of three men in an office sitting at a table. Looking over some notebooks, having a discussion, the caption reads, Roy Ware, Ken Moak, and David Bridge talk strategy for Chimerix. And then the two articles are under that. The first article has the headline, Company Poised for Breakthrough. And both of these articles are written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Durham. Chimerix CEO Ken Moak said at one point in 2012, that he felt he had tied his lasso to a telephone pole and it turned out to be a rocket ship. This year, that rocket ship, a.k.a. Durham antiviral developer Chimerix, is priming for a very public launch by filing for an $85 million initial public offering, one that could fund its lead candidate dubbed CMX-001. But is this really an attempt at going public, or is it perhaps a mating call for potential partners? Often drug development companies have used the securities registration process to announce that they are ready to do a deal. Whether it is through a public stock offering or perhaps with one single company interested in the filer's development pipeline. However, the current strength of the initial public offering market may lay to rest such an M&A strategy for now. Daniel Sweet, an analyst with IPO Boutique, says Chimerix makes a good case for a listing. It looks like pipeline-wise, they are a little farther along in the pipeline than some of the other IPOs that have gone through, which is always a good sign, he says, noting its lead antiviral is Phase 3 ready. Before or after the projected IPO, another eventually is possible, an acquisition of Chimerix by another larger company. Sweet notes that there are about 150 companies that have done similar types of filings and that a handful of those companies end up being acquired instead. The industry is all about consolidation, he explains. The Goliaths and the behemoth drug companies, so to speak, they're always looking for smaller David types of companies to replace some of the 10-year expirations on some of their drugs, he says. Capital needs trump others. For Chimerix CEO Moak, raising capital to move the drug development process is the main goal. Our hope is to keep CMX-001 in North America and then have a partner with global resources, Moak said in July, adding at the time that nothing was on the table or off the table regarding funding. The money can be raised either through a partnership, private or public fundraising. Now, nearly a year later, the documents tell the story. Chimerix is looking to go public as soon as practical on the NASDAQ market under the ticker symbol CMRX, bringing with it 46 Durham employees. As Sweet mentions, the Goliaths in the drug industry, one of those Goliaths out there is Merck, a name extremely familiar to Chimerix, as its primary revenue driver is a 2012 deal with Merck. The deal gave Merck & Company exclusive worldwide rights to an HIV drug dubbed 157. Merck will develop and commercialize 157, and in return, Chimerix nets a $17.5 million payment and up to $151 million in milestones, as well as future royalties. That's an interesting kind of partnership for something very early, notes Sweet. That could go to show that they're getting the eyes of some of the bigger pharma conglomerates and would be worthy of an acquisition down the line. Merck wouldn't comment on Chimerix's prospects as an acquisition target. Moak has said Chimerix will use proceeds of the Merck deal to develop its leading candidate, CMX-001, an antiviral aimed at treating patients with compromised immune systems, such as those whose immunity is suppressed after organ transplants. A securities filing indicates the public offering would also fund the 001. In addition to Chimerix's $85 million venture haul, more than $36 million in government grants have fueled 001. Initially developed as a biodefense drug to fight smallpox, 001's main focus, to prevent CMV infection in immunity-compromised patients, is Phase 3 ready. Moak has said the plan all along has been to focus on CMX-001 and that 157 was a means to an end, as a company of Chimerix's size didn't have the resources to develop an HIV drug on its own. But what if that means to an end goes sour? What happens if 157 fails and Merck's $150 million never materializes? Banking on executives, board. The company still has its leadership team that Christy Schaefer, former Inspire Pharmaceutical CEO and current venture partner at Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partner, says is a big part of what could bring it success with an IPO. Leading that team is Moak, who has built several life science companies and previously led Altio Incorporated and BioSite Corporation as CEO. Chimerix's chief medical officer is Dr. Michelle Berry, who was CMO of Pharmasset until it was acquired by Gilead Biosciences. The board of directors includes Ernest Mario, former CEO of Glaxo Holdings, as chairman. Other members include James Nadell, who once was chief science and technology officer for GlaxoSmithKline, and Arthur Pappas, director and managing partner of Pappas Ventures. Any deal can go south, but I know Ken well enough to know that he's going to do everything possible to keep that relationship, Schaefer says of Chimerix and Merck. Merck is a company that does a lot of due diligence on its technology, so they are more likely to have thought this through really carefully. But it's the Glaxo backbone that really pushes Chimerix ahead, she says, noting that when mergers happened in the 1990s, companies like Chimerix benefited from the fallout. Really smart scientists went to these companies, she says, noting that Glaxo was known for its antivirals. That's a pretty hot space right now, if you look at companies like Gilead and Vertex as examples. And Chimerix wants to be a part of that action. Chimerix expects that if the public offering is successful, the company will have enough cash to get to 2015. It currently has about $30 million in cash and liquid assets on its books. And the second article in this cover story section has the headline, Long Closed Window for IPOs Opens for 2013. And this is also written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. The delicate IPO window is opening, and local companies are determined to force their way through. Already this year, the Triangle has seen one public launch with LipoScience and two additional IPO filings with Durham's Quintiles and Chimerix. Investors in the Triangle are among those already entangled in the IPO scramble, and none more than Durham's A.M. Pappas & Associates, the largest life sciences venture capital firm in the area, and an investor in all three, Quintiles, Chimerix, and LipoScience. But that does not mean the VC is going to cash out and run. For many companies and their venture partners, this is a financing opportunity where we are bringing in other investment partners, managing partner Art Papa says. Not only that, in many cases, the existing investors are putting in as much as 40% into the new fundraiser. Pappas credits part of the IPO frenzy to the recently passed JOBS, Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, that made it easier for companies to file documents confidentially with federal regulators without a public review. Larry Robbins, partner at Raleigh's Wyrick Robbins Law Firm, says market conditions are also pushing IPOs to success. If you look at the Dow over the past 12 months, we've had a significant increase in the averages as well as the S&P and the NASDAQ, Robbins points out, saying it's creating a momentum that's even trickling to life sciences. I don't think we could have what we have in life science today without the general market conditions and positive attitude that the bankers and buyers are having. It's creating opportunities that didn't exist last year, particularly with businesses that have established revenue streams like Quintiles. They're real businesses with real revenue streams and real customers buying their products on a daily basis, Robin says. When you contrast this with those companies that might have been in exactly the same situation last year, you didn't have the market enthusiasm. Daniel Sweet, analyst with IPO Boutique, says the Triangle experience is a reflection of what's happening around the country. The market is in a much better place for any deal to work, he says, adding that it's not a blanket statement. A deal still has to have prospects. This is probably the best IPO market we've seen in the past 2 years. It's definitely a very healthy time to think about filing. Credit Suisse estimates there may be as many as 25 biotech-related stock offerings this year, up from 12 to 2012. A recent KPMG poll among venture capitalists shows similar sentiment, with two-thirds of respondents expecting an increase in IPO activity in 2013. Even deals that appear risky, such as those involving companies without a solid revenue stream, seem to have a chance. Investors are looking past that these days and saying, we see potential in the company, Sweet notes. But it could be a limited-time opportunity. That window could close at the slightest breeze, says Christy Schaefer, a partner with Hatteras Venture Partners and former CEO of Inspire Pharmaceuticals. While the window appears open, I do think there is a special pattern of company characteristics that is going to be required to lead a successful IPO opportunity, she says. Among those characteristics are revenue and maturity, both in drug development and partnership history. The most important aspect, she adds, can be management experience. The other characteristic that Quintiles, LipoScience, and Chimerix have in common is maturity. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Soon Take Your Putter Indoors to Hone Your Game. A group of families in Cary will open indoor greens, mini golf, and cafe, an indoor putting course concept that promises to be more attuned to real course conditions than your typical wacky golfing experience. The putting course will have a pro-style setup with more than 3,200 square feet of putting surface. It will offer 18 holes for putting and an area to allow golfers to practice putting and chipping. The owners even hope to set up a league, similar to how people enjoy the competition and camaraderie in a bowling league or a dart league, says Chris Flanagan, one of the investors. Flanagan says that while the course is synthetic grass, golfers shouldn't think of it as the traditional artificial turf surface typically found on mini golf courses. The turf simulates realistic putting conditions with a green speed, stip meter reading, of between 9 and 10. The course will have various undulations to challenge putters to read them. For those just looking for an evening of putting, an 18-hole round will cost $9, or groups can buy a 10-pack for $75. The facility will open soon at 1951 High House Road in a shopping center at the corner of Davis Drive in Cary. The Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary has started selling an Umstead signature line of bath and body products online. The five-year hotel and spa that is owned by Cary billionaire Jim Goodnight and his wife Ann Goodnight has also started selling some of the art pieces from its gift shop through the online store, including a hand-blown glass bird created by glass master Oiva Toika of Finland that sells for $295. Biz has an eye on a Peruvian cotton bathrobe for $98. They must have been saving the best for last. Hilda Pinnix Ragland of Cary, one of the top-ranking women executives at Duke Energy, was the last speaker invited to participate in this year's Chancellor's Distinguished Speaker Series at Fayetteville State University on March 12. Pinnix Ragland has been an officer with the utility and its predecessor company, Progress Energy, since 1998 and currently serves as Vice President of Corporate Public Affairs. She is also chair of the North Carolina State Board of Community Colleges Board of Directors and was recently confirmed to the National Parks Foundation Board of Trustees. Black Top Candies, which leads week-long national tours in classic cars, is starting up a tour closer to its home base in Cary. The company is leading several four-day tours of North Carolina this spring. They leave from Apex on Thursday mornings, arrive in Asheville on Friday evenings, and roll back into Apex on Sundays. The company was founded and is run by Scott Shin and his wife Candy. Its tours avoid interstate highways and stop at 60s-themed diners. Its cars, including a 1964 Chevrolet Corvette Stingray convertible and a 1955 Chevrolet Bel Air, do feature one major concession to modernity, however, GPS navigation systems. Nomacork has gotten into the green game by putting solar panels on the roof of its headquarters in Zebulon that will generate 400,000 kilowatt hours of power per year. Nomacork's founder and chairman, Mark Noel, made the investment as part of broader family commitment to sustainable energy. With prices for solar panels dropping, he decided now was the right time. The company sought consulting help from Sustainable Industrial Solutions, SIS, a Durham-based startup that helps manufacturers set up sustainable facilities, and contracted with Baker Renewables of Raleigh to install the panels. Many of our customers have been embracing renewable energy in their operations for several years, and we simply saw the solar panel installation as a continuation of our deeper corporate social responsibilities, Noel said. The 300-kilowatt solar array will produce 400,000 kilowatt-hours of electricity per year, which represents 4% of Nomacork's total energy use. It has the potential to produce carbon to reduce carbon emissions by over 600,000 pounds per year, according to the company. Rex Healthcare, part of the UNC healthcare system, has added three physicians to various specialty practices. Dr. Jason K. Kim joined Rex Vascular Surgical Specialist. Dr. Adnan Purvez and Dr. Kavitha Kotha joined Rex Pulmonary Specialists. With the additions, Rex Vascular Surgical Specialist has five doctors, and Rex Pulmonary Specialist has four doctors. Earlier this year, Dr. Grant Buntram, Dr. Robin Koeleveld, and Dr. Robert Layson formed Rex Neurosurgery and Spine Specialists after leaving Raleigh Neurosurgical Clinic, where they made up three of the practice's five doctors. The remaining doctors, Dr. Robert Allen and Dr. Russell Margraff, say they will continue to operate independently and are fighting the financial realities of becoming a smaller practice. Holly Springs-based OFM, an office and school furniture manufacturer, distributor, and wholesaler, has partnered with online retail software provider Shopatron to make its products available online. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jason DeBrun, Chris Bagley, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. The headline, Teaming Up on Medicaid. A consortium of hospitals and healthcare systems in North Carolina is finalizing recommendations for how to make the state's Medicaid system run better. This is an important decision, says Dr. Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare, who called it a mistake to not expand Medicaid, as state lawmakers have chosen to do. During a meeting with the UNC Healthcare Board of Directors, Roper said he personally talked to state leadership in an effort to change their minds. He and other healthcare leaders ultimately failed, and the General Assembly refused to expand Medicaid here. That aside, Roper and other healthcare leaders say they welcome a chance to present possible reforms to Medicaid, a system that spends $14 billion a year of mostly federal tax money on healthcare for low-income individuals and families in North Carolina alone. We think we have some very good ideas, Roper says. The State Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the disbursement of Medicaid benefits through its Division of Medical Assistance, distributed an open letter asking anyone for good ideas on repairing the system. The division has not been managed in a way to use our resources most efficiently, wrote DHHS Secretary Dr. Aldona Wose in the letter. This has not only resulted in a loss to the taxpayers through significant budget shortfalls for several years in a row, but also to patients, providers, and other stakeholders in the state's Medicaid program. It is still too early to know what specifics will be in the hospital's response, but it's highly likely that they will encourage the use of Community Care of North Carolina or a model that runs like it. Through a public-private partnership, CCNC brings together regional networks of healthcare providers and social service agencies and other community organizations that work together to provide cooperative, coordinated care through what is called the medical home model. This approach matches each patient with a primary care physician who leads a healthcare team. A December 2011 analysis by Milliman Incorporated, a national consulting firm based in California, found that CCNC saved North Carolina nearly $1 billion in healthcare costs over the four-year period from fiscal year 2007 through fiscal year 2010. In North Carolina, the model is benefiting more than 5,000 providers, 1.2 million patients, and 9 million taxpayers, according to CCNC. We believe that CCNC is a great vehicle for reining in medical costs, says Don Dalton, a spokesman for the North Carolina Hospital Association. In talking about Wose's call for help, Dalton says the hospital response will carry with it the weight of 131 healthcare systems throughout the state. CCNC also is expected to submit a response to Wose, but representatives said they were not yet ready to discuss specifics. The hospital recommendations were expected to be submitted on March 15. And now as we move down the page, we have two articles that are inside of a black box. Inside that box at the very top in bold red lettering, there's the headline, Game Changers, Stories of Two Individuals Out to Deliver Better Health Outcomes. And then underneath that, there are pictures of the two people. First, there's a man casually dressed in a lab. The caption reads, Cam Long stays focused in his Duke University lab. And then there's also another picture next to that of a woman in her office dressed in business attire that says, Myla Leigh Goldman left LabCorp to get back to her research roots. Now, both of these articles are written by Lauren K. Onsorge, with the first one that we're about to read has a dateline of Durham. Duke University biomedical engineer Cam Long wants to change the world, and he plans to do it with a gene pill. Already effective in mice, the results of his research could mean new effective oral ways to treat genetic disorders, and he's starting with hemophilia, a bleeding disorder. It's probably safe to say that there are still a lot of challenges, but I believe the promise, the potential is there, Long says. Working with 15 students in Duke labs, Long says lab mice have shown significant clotting improvement after imbibing a nanoparticle-laced gelatin developed by the team. An alternative existing therapy is an injection. You can imagine for a child born with that genetic disorder, injections are unwelcome, Long says. Leonard Poe doesn't have to imagine. His son Dalton was born with hemophilia B 18 years ago, a condition that means 3 intravenous injections a week. Imagine being injected 2,500 times before you're an adult, Poe says. It's not as easy as, say, insulin for diabetics. You have got to find a vein. Poe, advocacy director for the Raleigh-based North Carolina chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation, craves another option, a cheaper alternative that wouldn't mean injecting his son at a cost of $300,000 to $500,000 a year, along with other medical costs. While waiting for new treatment options, Poe spends his time advocating health care reform so that his son can afford treatment once he gets out of the Children's Health Insurance Program. And Long has heard about several children like Dalton growing up and unable to find health care. If we can deliver the gene and have the body function as a factory to produce this protein, it would last longer and be cheaper than current therapies, he says. A challenge in treating hemophilia has always involved the delivery method for medicines. Long's solution was to create a synthetic vessel on a nanoscale that could protect the gene on its journey to treat a patient. He uses chitosan fiber, which comes from crustacean shells, and can get inside cells to deliver protein-creating genes. Hemophilia A patients lack factor VIII proteins, and hemophilia B patients lack factor IX proteins. Long's treatment could get the body to create both factors, he explains, and it looks like it's working. In a normal mouse, clotting happens in 1 minute. In a hemophiliac B mouse, it's 3 minutes. 3 days after Long's treatment, the hemophiliac mouse clots at 1 minute. But how can you make sure the genes, once delivered in a pill, get where they need to go? You can't, at least not right now. That's what makes hemophilia such an ideal condition for the treatment. The genes can be processed in other cell types. Impacted cells will die, however, meaning the treatment would have to be repeated. Once Long's National Institutes of Health-funded research cracks the hemophilia puzzle, the findings could be used to develop treatments for more complex genetic disorders, he says. Currently, he's testing the treatment in dogs. Humans could follow in a few years, pending funding, he says. Robert Langer, professor of chemical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has said Long's technology has the potential to realize the ultimate goal of gene therapy, to apply a gene as a drug. And along with the article, there's also a red box that has some bullet point information concerning Cam Long. James B. Duke Professor. Honors include appointment on the National Academy of Engineering. StanCell Family Distinguished Research Award. PhD, University of Pennsylvania. Postdoc, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. B.S., University of California. And our second Game Changer article, also written by Lauren K. Onsorge, has a dateline of Chapel Hill. How can a startup have 2 platforms in venture backing but 0 employees? By having a creative founder, Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman. After nearly 2 decades at Burlington-based LabCorp, Leigh Goldman needed a new challenge. What I found most rewarding was the opportunity to work on new technology, she says, recalling research on tests for HIV, cancer, and genetic disorders. I really saw the impact that we could have with implementing transformational diagnostics. There's just something about new technology, she says, a particular rush that you just can't get at an established corporation. As I approached my 18th year at LabCorp, I really decided that I wanted to get back down to my technology roots and work with researchers to help them mature their technology, build evidence that their technology works so that they could really bring the new technology to patient care, she says. So she took the leap, quitting her job, but she had help, the former chief medical officer and chief scientific officer of LabCorp, had made a few friends along the way, namely the leaders of Hatteras Venture Group, where she became a venture partner. With potential backers, all she needed was good science. That's where Chuck Peru and Neil Hayes, professors at UNC Chapel Hill, came in. The pair's genomics research at the Leinberger Cancer Center was in need of a commercial partner. Hayes says that specifically the team needed Lay Goldman to impact patient care. I think as a researcher and a clinician, without having that kind of partnership and support, this never would have happened, he says. Myla approached us and said, I like your work. I think we could actually turn this into a test that we could provide to patients. Hatteras agreed, fronting $250,000 in seed money, intrigued by Lay Goldman's approach, that there would be no payroll to eat into the VC money. The reality is, GeneCentric has zero employees, she says. We're running the company virtually. The goal is to revalidate the technology in independent hands, something she was able to accomplish with her relationship with LabCorp. This allowed me to demonstrate to our team and now future investors that this technology really works, she says. LabCorp opted to license the technology and develop their own lab test. While she'll hire in the future, that will be after fully proving the company concept and making a profit. I think that these days where investment and venture money is perhaps a bit harder to get, it's incumbent upon us as entrepreneurs to be creative as we start companies and give our investors real confidence in what we are trying to accomplish, she says. Founded in 2011, GeneCentric Diagnostics utilizes two scientific platforms based on the UNC research. The first platform, the lung subtype platform, classifies lung cancer patients, particularly distinguishing between non-squamous and squamous forms of non-small cell lung cancer. Squamous cell cancer accounts for about 30% of non-small cell lung cancers in the United States, according to the National Institutes of Health, and starts in the bronchial tubes. It's also more aggressive and is treated differently than other lung cancers, hence the importance of making the distinction early. GeneCentric's second product, the Hypoxia platform, is an in-development test that analyzes whether breast cancer tumors are embedded in an oxygen-rich or oxygen-starved hypoxic environment, an important factor in prognosis and treatment. Both founding scientists have equity in the company. Though Lay Goldman won't be specific about the breakdown, she does confirm the company is raising money, but won't reveal a total. She is, however, looking outside Hatteras. The company has already created buzz, at least from the UNC community. Dr. Shelley Earp, director of the UNC Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, says the next era of cancer clinical trials and cancer care will be driven by a tumor's molecular signature. She calls Perot and Hayes world leaders in helping to bring those approaches to cancer patients. Other current directors include Hatteras vet Clay Thorpe and Arnold Levine, professor at the Simons Center for System Biology at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. The University of Cancer Research Fund also contributed to the research. Banks continue to heal based on Texas scores. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Steps taken by Triangle Banks to deal with problem loans and other assets during 2012 paid off by year's end as the industry made strides in regaining its health. The overall volume of portfolio problems dropped, even as a key measure of stress, the bank's Texas scores were heading down at 9 of 12 local institutions. In fact, at only two area banks, Four Oaks and Johnston County, and Chapel Hill-based Harrington Bank, were the warning signs continuing to flash. Asked if he thought the general trend showed an industry on the mend, Atlanta-based investment banker Lee Burrows, who tracks the industry throughout the Southeast, said, "Yes, I think that is true. Consumers are feeling a little more confident, and real estate prices have firmed considerably in the Triangle and through most of North Carolina over the past year or so." Also, adds Burrows, having not been the scene of any failed banks has helped the Triangle market find traction more rapidly. The traction is evident in the largest asset quality data collected by Monroe Securities. Triangle Bank's non-performing loans as a percentage of total bank assets fell to 2.61% in the fourth quarter, the lowest for any region of the state. Back in 2011, the figure was 5.05%, according to Monroe's Steve Huntington. The Texas score, or ratio, is a snapshot of a bank's financial position that comes from dividing its problem loans and foreclosures by its stockholders' equity and loan loss reserves. The score, a score of 50 or less, is considered good, one at or above 100 a warning, but not necessarily an indicator of potential failure. In the triangle during 2012, many banks were able to cut, some significantly, their scores. Among them is Raleigh-based Trust Atlantic, which shaved nearly 16 points to 20.1. During the year, Trust Atlantic bought Harrington's Falls River Avenue branch office in North Raleigh with its $25 million in deposits and $10 million in loans. CEO Jim Beck saw it as a ready-made growth opportunity. It normally takes 3 years to get a branch to break even, he says. This will break even almost immediately once you get the one-time costs out of the way. Beck, whose bank posted earnings of $5.2 million in 2012 while growing both total assets and loans by 6%, also subscribes to the notion that the industry is healing. I think bank balance sheets are improving faster than the overall economy is, he says. Fidelity spiffs up to win talent battle, and this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. When Fidelity Investments made the decision in 2006 to open a regional operations hub in the Triangle, which has since created 2,000 jobs, it was for three reasons, says Steve McCarthy, a regional site leader for Fidelity in RTP. Talent, talent, talent. We are seeing that in spades here, he says. Now Fidelity is focusing on improving its own workplace environment so that it can keep those employees as other companies, such as the recently announced 1,300 new jobs at MetLife will create in Cary, start to move into the region and recruit from the same talent pool. Fidelity, a Boston-based financial services firm, is wrapping up a nearly $20 million renovation of three former Nortel Networks office buildings in Research Triangle Park that Fidelity acquired in 2011. The Fidelity campus on NC54, recently renamed New Millennium Way after one of Fidelity's successful mutual funds, will have offices for about 2,600 workers once it's complete in May. About half of the Triangle staff work in the company's workplace investment group led by McCarthy. It includes a service call center that works with 30 of the company's strategic clients, including participants in IBM's pension fund, and hundreds of other individual clients who use Fidelity's 401k administration services. The other half of Fidelity's Triangle workforce is focused on technology. Deb Walsh is Senior Vice President of Personal Investing Technology for Fidelity in RTP and shares the regional site leader duties with McCarthy. You can have a long career here because we have so many different business units here, Walsh says. The RTP campus is also home to Fidelity's LEAP program, an entry-level training curriculum. As Fidelity recruits graduates out of colleges, universities, and the armed services, the new hires are sent to the RTP campus to train for 6 months. Fidelity provides apartments for those trainees who will be assigned to jobs here and at 10 other regional campuses. They like to stay here, and we understand why, she says. Figuring out health insurance shifts. This article is written by Jason DeBrun. Governor Pat McCrory put his John Hancock on a bill to reject Medicaid expansion in North Carolina. And with the dust settling on that decision, employers would do well to know how that affects the health insurance they provide to their employees. Skip Woody, with health benefits consulting group Hill Chesson and Woody, sat down with Triangle Business Journal to discuss the issue. Before getting into the Q&A, Woody noted that rejecting the Medicaid expansion does not impact the ability of a small employer with fewer than 50 employees to purchase group coverage through a federally facilitated Small Business Health Options Program or SHOP exchange. Companies with 50 or more full-time employees, including part-time employee hours that make up full-time equivalents, are subject to the employer shared responsibility mandate of reform, also known as the pay-or-play mandate, and should pay close attention. By not expanding the Medicaid system here, more employees will be eligible for a subsidy through the federally facilitated exchange. What does this mean for employers? Small businesses employing individuals with income between 100% and 133% of the federal poverty level face a greater risk of penalties if the business employs 50 or more full-time equivalent employees and does not offer coverage that is affordable and meets a minimum level of benefits. Small businesses also may face increased insurance costs as a result of the rejection of the Medicaid expansion. How could employers avoid penalties? Businesses subject to the employer shared responsibility mandate would need to offer a minimum level of coverage at an affordable cost, generally limited to 9.5% of an employee's income for employee-only coverage. This means employers will need to contribute more to the cost of coverage for lower-wage employees than they might for higher-wage employees. What are some tips for employers? Get to know your workforce, know which employees you must cover. For example, companies are not required to offer coverage to part-time employees working fewer than 29 hours per week, but be mindful of seasonal and transitional employees who may work more than 30 hours per week on average in a given month. Know which employees will qualify for subsidies. Employers won't have to pay a penalty on those employees who don't qualify for a subsidy, so the most cost-effective solution might involve paying a few penalties but still offering coverage. Once you have identified your workforce and the employees you have to cover, you need to decide if you will pay or play. This may be strictly a numbers decision, or it may also take into consideration the type of business you are in and the type of employees you want to attract and hire. Penalties do not apply to part-time employees. Can you modify your workforce and run your business with part-time help? This approach to managing the mandate is getting some attention, especially in the retail and hospitality industries. Any final thoughts? Many things are changing in the next 12 months, and it's not just the employer mandate. Employers that purchase insurance in the small market will see changes with respect to how their plans are rated. Some will see big increases, while others may see little change in cost or even cost reductions. Do the math. There's no shame in calculating the cost to provide insurance compared to the cost of paying penalties if you drop coverage. Given that the penalties are not tax deductible, many for-profit businesses will find that dropping coverage is not the least expensive approach. Delivering an e-cigarette with a jolt. This article is written by Lauren Onsorge with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. With smoking, size matters, says Michael Hufford, chief medical officer and mastermind behind Chapel Hill startup e-nicotine. Size in this case refers to particles of nicotine that, at least in a typical electronic cigarette, are too small to hit the deep lung, rendering a subpar puffing experience. That's why electronic cigarettes aren't as effective as they could be, he says, at least until now. He and his team have come up with an iPhone-sized device that aims to correct that flaw, offering up nicotine to a smoker at between 1 and 3 microns, the perfect size for an aerosol dose, he says. And he's looking for $3.3 million from investors in a fundraiser he hopes to complete within a few months. Previously, the company was bootstrapped. He says it's all about the technology that more closely mimics the initial uptake of nicotine one gets from a tobacco cigarette drag. It more closely mirrors what smokers are used to, he explains. One of the things that happens is rapid absorption. If particles are too small, they are breathed out. If they're too large, they are embedded and don't make an impact. While users of the device will continue to receive jolts of nicotine, which has addictive and damaging effects on the body, it will not contain other fillers and flavors found in real cigarettes. The Centers for Disease Control just released a report showing it could be a good time for new technology. Their findings show that 1 in 5 adult cigarette smokers has tried an electronic cigarette as of 2011, up from about 10% at last survey in 2010. More than 6% of total survey respondents had tried an e-cigarette. E-cigarette use is growing rapidly, CDC Director Tom Frieden said in a statement. There is still a lot we don't know about these products, including whether they will decrease or increase the use of traditional cigarettes. Hufford says his goal is to have the device cost no more than cigarettes. And now we turn to a Spotlight article in the Triangle Business Journal. The Spotlight is on deal makers, mergers, and acquisitions. And the headline, in 2012, deal makers returned to table. The market for mergers and acquisitions is back, not with a roar, mind you, but at least with indication that the economy is getting back to normal. And with this article, there are a number of pictures. First, there's a picture of two men dressed in suit and tie standing on either side of a podium. The caption reads, PNC Bank's chairman and CEO Jim Rohr, along with PNC's director of corporate real estate Gary Salson, at last year's annual shareholders meeting, PNC bought RBC Bank USA for $3.45 billion in 2012. And also with this article, there's a picture of a man casually dressed sitting in an office. The caption reads, Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers. And this article is written by Chris Bagley. The Triangle's 10 largest deals with known values in 2012 totaled about $38.5 billion, dwarfing the $6 billion total value of the 10 largest of 2011. They range from the Shaw Group's acquisition of a 50% stake in Durham-based Net Power, a value of about $50.4 million, all the way up to Raleigh-based Progress Energy Incorporated's $32 billion merger into Duke Energy Corporation. Progressive alone engaged two law firms in those negotiations. But last year's total grew from 2011 even without accounting for the Duke Progress merger, and securities attorneys say there were quite a few mergers and acquisitions in the $20 million to $50 million range. Add to that a handful of comparably large deals whose values they couldn't disclose, such as the Chinese social media company Tencent's acquisition of a minority stake in Epic Games, the Kerry-based video game developer. 2012 was the first year in a while where domestic M&A activity was normal in terms of buyers' and sellers' expectations, says Gerald Roach, a securities lawyer with Smith Anderson, which handled several of the largest deals last year. Roach and other attorneys say they began to note a significant improvement in 2011, but mainly in cases where buyers were absolutely sure that the target companies fit into their business plans. Buyers remained similarly focused in 2012, Roach says, even as they became more confident. Securities attorneys say financing has also improved, leading to fewer situations where buyers pull the plug at the last minute. A resurgent stock market, for one thing, has given publicly traded companies ammunition to go hunting for acquisition targets, insofar as they've been able to use their shares as currency. In 9 of the 10 largest deals last year, the larger company was publicly traded. Roach says buyers remain focused on acquisitions that are truly strategic. Even into 2013, he says he sees a healthy market that hasn't changed much from 2012. Several industries had particularly strong activity last year, notably in the energy sector. Nationally, the accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers counted 75 mergers and acquisitions among oil and gas companies in the last 3 months of the year, the highest total in 10 years. Utility mergers, most of which were considerably smaller than the Duke Progress deal, were also happening at twice the rate of 2011, PwC says. The combinations have a lot to do with depressed demand for electricity, due both to the slow economic recovery and consumers' improved efficiency, says Jeremy Fago, the team leader for PwC's Power and Utilities Transaction Services. Duke and Progress also cited those factors in their decision to merge. Gene Jones, securities attorney at Morningstar Law Group in Mooresville, says he's noticed financing improving mainly for large buyers that are able to raise capital in public markets. Hesitation among banks and other lenders has kept somewhat of a lid on acquisitions and mergers of less than $50 million. And a healthy supply of deals is in the pipeline, securities attorneys say, not to mention IPOs. Quintiles, for example, is expected to go public this year in a nine-figure deal. Stay tuned. And in the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal, the story is concerning Sutton's Drug Store. Along with this article, there's a picture of two men, one with a white pharmacist coat on, the other wearing a blue Sutton shirt with a Sutton's emblem for the store. Standing inside the store, the caption reads, Sutton's drugstore owner, John Woodard, and general manager, Don Pinney. The headline, Still Serving Dogs, Filling Scripts After 90 Years on Franklin Street. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. In many ways, Sutton's drugstore on Franklin Street hasn't changed in the last 90 years it's been in business. The pharmacist at the back counter is still filling prescriptions per doctor's orders. The milkshakes at the lunch counter are still a popular item for locals stopping in for a visit. The cook at the kitchen's flat-top grill can still churn out a mean grilled cheese sandwich or hot dog or cheeseburger with a side of fries. But how Sutton's drugstore has managed to stay in business for so long has little to do with the speed at which a patient's prescription is filled or how cheap the hot dogs are each Tuesday and Thursday, $3.50 for a loaded weenie with fries. It's more about the service and the atmosphere within the crowded 1,900-square-foot shop. It's about the people working there and the clientele they attract. Roy Williams, head coach of UNC Chapel Hill's men's basketball team, regularly gives a shout-out to Sutton's on his radio show. Many of Williams' players, as well as members of the UNC football team, are regulars at Sutton's as well. Basketball jerseys, signed, framed, and hung from the ceiling of Sutton's adds touches of nostalgia. The most recent addition is the jersey of Tyler Zeller, a Tar Heel standout now playing for the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. Tyler loved our cheeseburgers, says Sutton's general manager Don Pinney. The walls of the shop are covered with 8x10 photographs of both famous and not-so-famous customers. Pinney says he isn't even sure how many photographs he has on the wall, but he knows he has about 10,000 more tucked away in storage. I have to take down some before I can put more up, he says. One of Sutton's breakfast regulars, UNC drama teacher David Adamson, says he keeps coming back because he likes the people there and the service he gets. As long as they don't have a mob, Don lets me sit here at the end of the lunch counter and do my puzzles, Abramson says. I'm comfortable here. The service for me is excellent. But Sutton's, which has been in continual operation since 1923, is facing a new wave of competition the store has never seen before, Penny concedes. A Walgreens drugstore opened down the street a couple of years ago, siphoning away much of the remaining student business that had been going to Sutton's pharmacy counter, which is still manned by Sutton's owner and operator, John Woodard, Jr. Another national competitor, CVS, could be moving to a building on Franklin Street later this year. According to market research firm Chain Store Guide, Sutton's drugstore generated about $1.2 million in combined pharmacy and non-pharmacy sales in 2011, and it captured about 2.3% of the pharmacy market share in Chapel Hill that year. Franklin Street, Penny says, used to have a more varied mix of retailers now filled with eateries and bars. The university's dining hall options for students have also been expanding, Penny says, which has impacted many of the food vendors along Franklin Street. I work on a 6% margin, Penny says. Food is not a big margin business, and when you're trying to do quick serve and made to order, it's tough. A cheeseburger with chips at Sutton's costs $4.99, and that price has only gone up 94 cents in the last 16 years, Penny says. We try to keep up with sheer volume to keep our prices low. We know everybody's on a budget, he says. He cuts costs, he says, by working out deals with his food vendors for bulk orders. Sutton sells about 900 to 1,000 hot dogs in a week and about the same number of cheeseburgers. About 60% of the annual revenue at Sutton's drugstore comes from its food sales at the lunch counter that has seating for only 58 people. Penny says he'd like to one day add seating and extend the store hours, but he says that would require a much larger kitchen. That would likely have to happen after Woodard, who is 69, retires or sells the business. John is in the lifeblood of this store, Penny says. I don't really want to be here without him. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Troy's First Bank relocating headquarters to Southern Pines. First Bank Corp. CEO Richard Moore says the $3.3 billion 98-branch bank will relocate its headquarters from Troy to Southern Pines. Our bank has grown dramatically over the past few years, and this new location will help us better serve our customers going forward, Moore says in a news release. The bank plans to consolidate some of its operations in a recently purchased building at 300 Southwest Broad Street in downtown Southern Pines. The step of actually transferring its headquarters there would have to be approved by regulators. First Bank says it will keep the vast majority of its corporate jobs in Troy by continuing to operate a back office and data processing center there. We currently have about 190 corporate headquarters jobs, and at least 150 of them will remain in Troy, says Moore. McCrory signs bill eliminating tax credit. Governor Pat McCrory signed legislation on Wednesday that repeals the state's earned income tax credit after December of 2013. The measure also cuts the credit from the current 5% to 4.5%. A coalition of groups, including Action NC, the United Way Incorporated, and the North Carolina Justice Center, had spoken out against the action. In 2011, roughly 900,000 low- to moderate-income North Carolina taxpayers took the credit, receiving refunds of about $105 million. Former North Carolina CIO Bacolia gets new gig. George Bacolia, the state's chief information officer during the Michael Easley administration, will join the Department of Public Safety to head up North Carolina's participation in the new National Public Safety Broadband Network, FirstNet. The appointment was announced by new Public Safety Secretary Karen Shanahan. With his years of government experience and private sector information technology background, George Bacolia has the ability and know-how to lead this effort, says Shanahan. It's critical that our first responders and emergency managers are able to communicate quickly and effectively. FirstNet is the next step in the evolution of our interoperable communication systems. Campbell Law School ranks nationally. Three Triangle Universities held strong in the most widely watched annual ranking of the nation's law schools, which was published Monday. Perhaps the biggest news was that Campbell University broke into U.S. News & World Report's rankings. Campbell's Norman Adrian Wiggins School of Law, which moved to downtown Raleigh from Buies Creek in 2009, was number 126 of the 149 ranked schools. The magazine said 194 of the 203 accredited law schools in the U.S. participated in its survey this year. U.S. News lists schools with lower scores, including Campbell last year, without ranks. A UNC Chapel Hill law school rebounded to a number 31 ranking after slipping to number 38 in 2012. The school's environmental law program was among the best in the nation, the magazine said. And we're going to stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.